Okay, today on this Monday morning's Dhamma talk, I'm going to be continuing with the subject on meditation, just keeping on at the same theme. But this morning I wanted to ground it in the word of the Buddha, the suttas. In particular, I wanted to go through the Anapanasati Sutta. When, again, as a young monk, I sort of first started looking through those suttas and trying to find out not just what, say, Ajahn Chah taught about meditation, or what this monk or that teacher taught about meditation, but what did actually the Buddha teach about meditation? And you went through a lot of those teachings trying to find some instructions, and at first I couldn't really spot it because of the not so good translations into English in the early days. But then sooner or later you came across the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the teaching about the breath meditation. And when you looked at that more deeply, especially with your own knowledge of meditation, then you found out just what a beautiful and very profound and inspiring teaching that was about how to meditate. Even though that was on the meditation on the breath, those same stages of Anapanasati can be applied to all types of meditation, because it was the Buddha's understanding about how to let go of the mind, exactly what to do, when and how. So I'm going to give the deep teaching of meditation today. That Anapanasati Sutta begins with a prologue, that your person goes to a quiet place. And it's important to have a quiet place before you start meditating, unless you are very proficient, because the disturbances from outside will create a hindrance for you, again, if you don't know how to discard them and ignore them. For the person who hasn't got that skill of being able to sit in the middle of the city and just really let go and turn off those sounds, then it's not a wise thing to try and meditate in such situations. That's why we have retreats in quiet places, and we try and ask people to keep noble silence and not make too many noises, because the external silence is very crucial at the very beginning. And then it says you go to a nice place to sit meditation, even on a heap of straw, it says. And again, that makes the point that you're going to a place of comfort. The heap of straw is a nice cushion. One cushion, two cushions, three cushions, four cushions. It doesn't matter how many cushions, as long as you're comfortable. Or a chair will do. A place where you can be reasonably comfortable. So don't go sitting on the ground, hurting, having pain here and pain there, thinking you're going to get somewhere. Go and sit on the chairs. And again, don't sit that long that you really get a lot of pain and you develop negativity towards meditation. Very often that ill will of hindrance to meditation, the ill will towards a meditation object, or even towards meditation in general, occurs because we push ourselves too much, we don't get fun and joy out of meditation, and psychologically, whether we want to do it or not, we will not do it, because it's associated in our mind with pain rather than with fun. So we get a nice heap of straw, cushion, a stool, and then we sit in a quiet place. And then they say we set up mindfulness in front of us. And mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. That preliminary of just setting up mindfulness in front of you, that's in this system which I've been explaining here, that's those first two stages of present moment awareness and silence. It's getting like mindfulness in the present moment, mindfulness here, mindfulness in front of you. Because the past is a long way away from you. It's way back there. And the future is way over there, a long way in front of you. But here we've got a mindfulness right in front of you, which means in the present moment. Mindfully breathing in and breathing out means you're not thinking about other things, you're just breathing. And those two initial stages of the meditation should be looked at very carefully. If you don't spend enough time on those two stages, when you actually start to watch the breath, you find you can't do it. The reason why you can't do it is because those two practices, present moment awareness and silence, clears away some of the major obstacles to being able to stay with the breath. If you try to watch the breath and you can't do it, why is that? What else are you watching? You're either watching thoughts or past or future, most of the time. So this is clearing away those obstacles. So you do some present moment awareness, either just listening to the birds outside, or just, you know, with what you're eating, just making sure one spoon at a time, just not allowing yourself to think about your home or your business or what you're going to do next, bringing everything inside, developing that quietness and silence of the mind. And the more you practice that, the easier it is when it's time to go into the breath to watch the breath, because the disturbances have all been settled down. And once you can start to watch the breath, you start on the Buddha's teaching of Anapanasati proper. There's 16 steps in this teaching. And the first step is, our first two steps, just if it's a long breath or a short breath, you know. In other words, you just know the breath. It's going in, it's going out. That's enough. Long or short, that's just to make it interesting for you. This is why that to watch the breath, giving some interest to what you're doing, making it a game, making it play, really helps. Any of you who have been teachers or who know anything about education, psychology, know that if you make the task fun and make it a game, children pay more attention, they learn more readily. And it's the same with meditation. If we make it a game, we make it fun, we play with it, then it becomes much more effective. So, number one, don't take this too seriously. That's why I always, you know, telling jokes and stuff like that, just to sort of lighten things up. I just was talking about desire the other day. There was this couple, they were going on their 25th wedding anniversary, and they decided to go and visit the place where they'd gone on their honeymoon. And it just happened to coincide with both of their 50th birthdays. And when they were going along the beach on this little resort where they went for their honeymoon, this bottle washed up, and sure enough, when they rubbed it, a genie came out and said, I'll give you a wish. And they said, oh, that's marvellous, because actually it's our wedding anniversary and it's also both of our 50th birthdays. And the genie took compassion on them and said, okay, I'll give you two wishes, one wish each, because it's your birthday. And said, asked the woman first of all, what's your wish? And she said, well, look, we've been working hard all our lives. Now we're 50. It'd be wonderful if we could retire. So can we have £1 million? And straight away, the genie rolled its wrist and opened its wrist, and there was a bank check for £1 million. And he gave it to the woman. She was so happy. And then he asked the man, he said, well, what's your wish? And the man looked at his wife and said, well, quite frankly, I wish I was married to a woman 30 years younger than me. And so straight away he got transformed into being 80. And that's the problem with desire. He got what he wanted, but not quite what he wanted. So keep it light in this meditation, because when you got happiness, it's much easier to meditate. And I'll come back to that. Well, actually, the Buddha comes back to that later on in the meditation. So when we're watching the breath, we make it interesting, make it fun, make it enjoyable. Do some counting, count backwards, whatever you do, just to get the mind onto that breath. So that's focused. When the mind is focused on the breath, at that stage, the first two stages of the breath meditation taught by the Buddha, where you're watching the long breath or the short breath, it means you just notice the breath is happening. Every in-breath, every out-breath, at least you know that much. You're breathing in, you're breathing out. At that stage, you can still be aware of many other things. You can be aware of the body, sometimes sound, sometimes thoughts. But a very good technique at this stage to make sure that that stage is achieved is again the simile of that screen, the TV screen. Whatever you put in the center of the screen will stay, and what's on the edges of the screen will disappear after a while. So if you're actually looking at the television screen in the middle, The flower pot disappears, the magazines underneath disappears, the edges of the screen disappears, and you're only left with the middle after a while. That's natural, that's called focusing. However, if you focus on the flower pot above the television, then after a while the television disappears and all you see is the flower pot. In the same way that this screen we call consciousness in the mind, what you're actually aware of, whatever is in the center of that screen we call consciousness will remain. What's on the edges will eventually disappear. So when you're watching the breath, make sure the breath is in the center. That's your main focus. That's where you're really aiming. If there's other things come to disturb you, feelings in the body, sounds from outside, or thoughts running through the mind, keep them on the edge, and they'll disappear. The problem is that whether it's a feeling in the body, a sound, or a thought, we give them priority. We make them more important, and that becomes the center of our screen, and the breath falls off. That's how we lose the breath. And that is a very powerful metaphor, because that's exactly how it works. In the beginning you can be aware of the breath, and if there's other things which are trying to interrupt you, don't try and push them away, because that's just making them the center of your screen. And you find you won't push them away, they will remain, the breath will disappear. So you can keep them in the mind, but don't give them as much importance as the breath. The breath remains in the center, and they're sort of in the background somewhere. You find as you focus more and more, they go recede further and further away from the center, and they disappear. So to get that breath centered, and especially if you've got many other things going on in the mind at the same time, because there's a bit of restlessness or pain or whatever, remember that simile and keep the breath in the center. So once that breath is in the center, then the third stage of Anapanasati, as the Buddha described it, is the full awareness of the breath. It's the whole breath being watched, sabbakaya patisamvedi. And this is where we see the breath from the very beginning to the very end of each in-breath, of each out-breath. You can even see the gap between the breaths. And it's very important to be aware of that gap between the breaths, because when the breath sensation is at its weakest, that's usually the time that hindrances can really play and insert thoughts or sounds or feelings in the body, because the breath sensation is very weak there, and it's an opportunity very often that the mind loses its object at those points. That is why it's many meditators, skillful meditators, say, well, just watch the gap between the breaths. And to make it interesting, find out which one is longest, the gap between the in-breath and the out-breath, or between the out-breath and the in-breath. Which is the longest? When you're watching the whole breath, sort of, does the sensation of the breath stay the same from the very beginning of an in-breath right the way through to the end of an in-breath? Or does it change in intensity or texture or what? What does this in-breath do? Is the in-breath feel the same as the out-breath? Or are they completely different feelings and sensations? Which one is longer? Which one is shorter? Does it reach the intensity of feeling in the middle? Or is it like my breath? It just builds up and builds up to an intensity and suddenly drops until it disappears. How does your breath work? So by investigating all these little details which you, maybe have not known before, if not really considered existed, it means you're putting interest in the breath, you're focusing more on it, and it becomes more fascinating. The breath which you're breathing, is that exactly the same feeling as the last breath? Is all breath the same? So you become like an investigator of these breaths. With that investigation, it helps keep the breath in mind, because it's interesting. It's not just another breath, it's a special breath. And there's so much that you have to do with it. It keeps the mind occupied, involved, until such time as the mind settles down on that breath. And that's only the third stage of this Anapanasati, to keep the full awareness of the breath. And if you apply yourself, there's no reason why you can't achieve that stage, with not too much difficulty, as long as you really want to. It's called aspiration rather than craving. And even though I've really put down all types of craving and wanting at the beginning of this retreat, now's the time to get some aspiration going. So actually to determine, this is what I want to achieve. Because when you set yourself goals, you'll actually work harder. Setting yourself goals is just when you go on a journey, making sure you've got a destination. If you haven't got a destination, you just go around in circles getting lost. So give yourself destinations, but be careful when you give destinations and aspire to those destinations, make sure you never get frustrated. Frustration is only an indication of impatience. You're not giving it time. Sometimes it takes a long time. It's very worthwhile giving it the time. You're going to be here anyway for another few days. You might as well make the most of it. So make those aspirations and see if you can get the full attention on the breath. When you've got the full awareness of the breath, which means that there's no part of the breath you're missing, you see at the beginning to the end to the beginning. Again, I should have mentioned, this is not beyond just an ordinary person's ability. You know, people like, if you play music and you're playing a piano, you're fully there all the time until you finish the piece. You know, if you start thinking about what you're going to do, you miss it and you forget what you're supposed to be playing. Even if you're writing a letter or typing something on the computer, you could actually, you have to focus there until you're finished. You have to be right with the task. I was talking to someone the other day that a doctor I knew some time ago, he was a surgeon. I was asking him, how can you sort of stand there and perform these operations for so many hours? Don't you feel tired? And the doctor said, actually, it's amazing that I don't feel tired when I'm performing an operation. In fact, now I get so peaceful when I'm operating on a person. And he said, because I have to focus just on, you know, the end of my knife. And because I'm focused for many hours on that, I don't actually feel the legs. I feel tired afterwards. But I don't feel any pain in the legs or the back when I'm bent over just operating this, because I don't feel my body at all. All my focus just is on the end of the knife and the body. And that's meditation, that's samadhi. And that's why they get peaceful doing that. Because they're fully focused, so they're not distracted. And that's also why they become very skilled as surgeons. They're fully with what they're doing. And it's not that hard for a person to achieve that. So I've been given many, many tips how to get to that stage. And that stage, you know, is so important, because once you get to there, the rest starts to become very easy and also great fun. It's hard work up to full awareness of the breath. Once you get to full awareness of the breath, then you really get into the fun stuff. And you really feel that you're getting somewhere, and you get a lot out of the stages which follow. Because after you get full awareness of the breath, from the very beginning to the end of each breath, and there's hardly any gaps between your attention at all, the next stage is actually to calm that breath down. Actually to make it softer. Now, there's two ways of doing that. One is just being patient and allowing it to settle down by itself, which it does quite naturally. And the other way is just to take away control. And to remember, even to tell the gatekeeper, just three words, calm, calm, calm. It's amazing that gatekeeper at that stage will know what to do, calm, 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 three times, and it will settle the breath down, it will go calmer much quicker. What I mean by going calm is the breath will become more and more refined. It doesn't go so deep into the body, it doesn't feel so coarse. It becomes a very soft and very refined breath. Now there's a danger to that stage, of that fourth stage, of calming the breath down, and that is if your mindfulness, your attention, the quality of your looker, knower, if that's not strong enough, when the breath gets very soft, very often it gets too soft and the mindfulness can't find it anymore. And it's as if the breath disappears. The breath hasn't disappeared. The time for breath disappearing comes much later. And if it disappears at this stage, you go into a peaceful state, but it's not good enough. It's peaceful, and there's nothing much going on there, but it's got no energy, it's got no oomph to it. And, you know, you're stuck there, and you can't go into a deeper stages of meditation. Be careful of that. The breath has disappeared too soon, because the mindfulness hasn't been sharp enough. So you have to train the mindfulness at this stage to be very alert. You can look upon the breath like this person which a detective is trailing. And if a detective is trailing a suspect, that suspect might sort of duck into a doorway, might go into the shopping mall, might sort of go up some stairs and try and escape being followed. But a detective who's very skilled at surveillance, if he sees that the suspect going to the left, he will also go to the left. If he sees it going to the right, she will go to the right. It will always be sharp enough to follow where the breath goes. And this is what you have to do at this stage. Be very sharp. If you lose the breath at this stage, you should ask yourself, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? Which one is it? It's interrupting the silence, but you need to do this. And the knowledge will come in, you're breathing in or you're breathing out. And straight away with that knowledge is the feeling of the breath. You've got the breath back again. Don't lose it a second time. Follow it like a hawk follows its prey. Like a cat watches a mouse. Really alert, really following. That is where effort is required in meditation. Not effort to do, but effort to know. So that's where you have to put in your energy, into the knower, not the doer. There's two parts of the mind, that which knows, that which does. Really boost up the knower at the expense of the doer. So the doer just goes really quiet, but the mindfulness goes right up. So extremely alert. See if you've had 3 cups of strong coffee. Wow! Now when you actually start to do this, you get the full awareness of a very calm breath. In the next stage which happens is what I sometimes call, again, a really important stage, again, where people miss out. They don't go into the deep stages of meditation, don't get the great fun out of meditation, don't appreciate meditation, because once you've got that calm breath, and you shouldn't calm the breath until you've got the whole breath, so I should have mentioned that first of all. You've got to catch hold of the breath first of all, and then calm it. Don't calm it before you've fully got hold of it. Otherwise, again, it disappears. So know the whole breath. If it's difficult to know the whole breath, even make it a bit more coarse. And breathe in a bit harder. Hold your breath or something, because at the very beginning, especially if you're tired or you're sleepy, that's a nice way of really getting hold of this breath. This is Ajahn Chah's teaching. He said, if you can't find the breath, you know, in the morning, you come out here 4 o'clock or 4:30, and you sit here, you just can't find the breath because you're half asleep. Stop breathing. Hold your breath. Only for about 30 seconds, but make it long. And then when you start breathing again, you'll be very prominent. It's very easy to find the breath. So get hold of the breath first of all, and then calm down. If you calm down before you've got the breath, then you're asleep. So that third stage, know the breath, the whole breath. The fourth stage, calm the breath down. It is very soft. When that breath is very, very soft and very, very subtle, again, it can be lost because you don't know really what you're watching, and it's so refined, it can't really grab the attention sometimes. Which is, to continue on, you should go very quickly from the calming the breath to the fifth and sixth stages of the Anapanasati Sutta, which I emphasize a lot in the monastery and retreats as well. Where the Buddha said, as you breathe in and breathe out, you develop piti sukha, this bliss and happiness in the mind. He said, you have to develop this. You have to look for it. You have to generate it. It is there, but it needs to be developed. Piti is this great sort of enthusiasm for what you're doing. like the inspiration in what's happening. Wow, it's great. And the sukha is the sheer happiness of it. And sometimes it's very difficult to distinguish these two terms, piti and sukha, because they go together just so close, like inseparable twins. So this was the fifth and sixth stages which the Buddha actually explained. And this is where I'm going to pause and talk a lot in this morning's talk, how to develop this happiness and bliss and enthusiasm in the meditation object at this stage. In my system, I call this developing the beautiful breath. And you really make it beautiful. You're watching the breath going in and going out. It's very, very soft. If you don't get this beauty coming up, this joy coming up, again, you cannot proceed any further. And again, this is a time when you can really get fun out of the meditation, because this is where you get lots of energy, lots of bliss, lots of happiness coming up, and it makes the meditation retreat worthwhile. Already some people have come into the meditation interviews and say, wow, I had a really beautiful meditation. For those of you who started meditating, you wonder, what the heck are they talking about? For me, meditation, sore back, sore knees, trying to watch the breath, and doing it again and again, it's just so boring. What am I doing this for? You're doing this so you can train yourself to get that bliss. So once you start getting this bliss, then you understand, you know, what these monks have been going on about all these years. About, you know, meditation is some of the highest happinesses. But to do this, you've got to, at that stage, when you've calmed the breath down, you've got to develop the beauty. Now that beauty is always there, but it's very hard for us to see it when our minds are so coarse that we're only really sensitive to really exciting things. There's two types of happiness in the world. The happiness which is due to excitement, and the happiness of like beauty, which is not so much exciting, but it's always there, very, very soft and delicate beauty. It's the difference between the beauty of the sound of the wind and the trees, and the excitement of a rock concert. You know, one is very coarse, and the other one is very refined. Unless you've trained your ears and are really sensitive and been told that it exists, you'll never notice it. For once you're told, and the Buddha said, there is that piti sukha, that happiness and enthusiasm with the breath, once you know it's there, and once monks like me keep on talking about it again and again and again, then you'll start to look for it. What is this anyway? Once you start to look for it, you'll probably find it. Because you're looking in the right direction. When we talk about perception, you have all these things you can perceive. And sometimes that we perceive things out of habit. We believe the breath is boring, it's ordinary, there's nothing there. For that reason, that's all we see. Perception is like supermarket shelves. You've got the supermarket shelf, you've got all these different types of muesli on the shelf. Why is it that people always pick the same brand of muesli? And they don't go picking any others? Because actually when they go to the supermarket, that's all they see. That is what they go to the supermarket to look for. That's all they see, that's what they pick up, that's what they put in their trolley and buy, and then eat. There's many other types of muesli there. Some may be even more cheap, more delicious, more healthy, but we eat out of habit. In the same way that what we experience with the breath, we're eating out of habit. There's so many more things in there, but we don't perceive them because we're not looking for them. But once somebody points out, a best friend, say, look, there's this really great muesli, sort of, you know, in Kmart, no, Walmart, or what are the shops is that? I don't know. In the supermarkets, whatever it is. Coles or Myers, I don't know. Now Myers doesn't sell food, does it? Okay. I only go to hardware shops. They don't sell muesli there. So whatever the shop is, whenever you go there, if somebody shows this is really amazing muesli, just so much more delicious than all the other mueslis, and it's really cheap and it's really healthy, it's on special offer for the 9-day retreat, this piti sukha is on special offer, half price. And you say, wow, you can actually go there looking for it. Now, where is this? And then actually you find it. And then you take it off the shelf, you buy it, you taste it. Wow, you know, Ajahn Brahm was right. This is really nice. Well, I've always been having this rotten old music all the time. And this is what happens with looking for that piti sukha. You know, once you've been told it's there, you'll start to look for it and you'll find it. But it's the happiness, which starts off just the happiness of this is really nice, this is soft, this is delicate, this is beautiful. In the Potapada Sutta, we call it sukhama. Sukh, it's very refined. It's again like a person can train themselves to that taste, you know, the beautiful foods or beautiful wines or beautiful teas. They become connoisseurs of great coffee. And they just know where the best coffee in the whole of Perth is. And someone like me just wouldn't know, you know, one coffee from another coffee. But they had seen that taste and they could really delight in that refined breath. Really, that happiness is there because it's the happiness of lots of business and lots of trouble and lots of difficulty disappearing. It's the happiness which is born of something having gone. It's not the happiness of something being there. It's the happiness born of afflictions gone. Disappear. It's the same type of happiness when a person has been sick and then suddenly they get better again. And they feel so happy that the sickness is gone. Or the happiness when you've been working all week and Friday evening you go home and affliction has disappeared. You feel happy. In the same way, so that when you get to that beautiful breath, it's as if a lot of work has been finished. A lot of burdens have been put down. It's as if you've been carrying a big backpack laden with stones and now you put it down. You feel free. It's a happiness born of a freedom, born of a letting go. That's where it comes from. Later on you can reflect upon that and say, why does that you know the taste of the happiness and then know the cause of that happiness. But you have to get that happiness first of all. Look for it, develop it. If you can't see it, first of all, imagine it. Using imagination in meditation can be a very powerful tool. Imagine you're breathing in just so beautifully and breathing out so beautifully. Do it now, just imagine, just a beautiful breath. Just imagine it. Now, what sort of breath are you breathing in anyway? It's a beautiful one, isn't it? What imagination does, it just opens the door for the reality to come in. Even in modern motivational psychology, they say if you want to be a millionaire, imagine you're a millionaire first of all, that's the first step. It's a stupid thing to do, to want to be a millionaire, but nevertheless, imagine yourself have a beautiful breath. That's a much more better thing to do. It's more burden, more worries. So imagine yourself have a beautiful breath. And then you can do it. You can see it. Once you see it, then you can pick it up and it's yours. Now it's a very important stage in the meditation, developing that beautiful breath. All you need to do is look for it and it's there. You can find it. You may take a little bit of searching. Where is this beautiful breath? Feel. Stop thinking. Feel this moment. Is this nice? Once you actually start to see it, it starts to grow. And becomes even more beautiful. And once you get to that beautiful breath, the meditation from that point on gets very easy. It gets very easy because it is not your willpower doing the meditation anymore. It's not willpower forcing the attention onto the object and holding it there. It is the joy in the meditation object pulls your attention there. And it holds it. The piti sukha, the joy, the happiness, is the glue which sticks mindfulness onto the object effortlessly. And that's why that, you know, that I try and crack jokes, try and laugh, try and smile at each other to get up that perception of happiness. And do that during the day. Develop the perception of the beautiful. When you go outside, don't just go outside, you know, just walking on the grass and just going out just thinking of what you're going to do next or when's dinner going to be. Go out and just look at the grass and see if you can see the beauty in that grass. stop by the flower and just really look for the beauty in it. When you go and see a tree, just see how much beauty you can experience in just watching the tree. Stay there and drink as much beauty as you can. What you're doing is training yourself to see the beauty in the ordinary. Whether it's a tree, whether it's a flower, piece of grass, do it with that first of all. And then when you're good at seeing the beauty in a flower, in a blade of grass, or in a tree, then go look at a brick in the wall. And see if you can see the beauty in that brick. Look for it, and it will open out to you. And once you can see the beauty in the bricks, then come in here and look at the carpet. And see if you can see the beauty in this carpet. So you can really drink all the beauty in. What you thought was a cheapo carpet, you see is an amazingly beautiful thing. And go outside and look at the concrete on the veranda. The most ordinary thing, which you thought was not beautiful, if you look for the beauty in there, you're going against your conditioning, concrete is ugly, and you can actually start to see beauty in it. See the world in a grain of sand, the heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, eternity in an hour. William Blake. This is developing that perception of beauty. This is the time to do that in the meditation. Later on you can do the super meditations and all that sort of stuff, but not now. Now is the time to develop happiness in nature, peaceful things. Don't go around looking at those good guys, don't go around looking at the girls and getting the beauty in them. Don't do it in the boys, because that's a bit dangerous. But in concrete there's no danger. So when you start to see the beauty in a bit of concrete, then you're training yourself. When you're training yourself to do these things, you find when you eat your lunch, it's delicious. As somebody said the other day, after a good meditation, they usually don't like sort of the food here because they were Asian, but the food was just so delicious. And everything was just so happy because the perception of the beautiful had been established. Once you can establish that in your what you're doing outside, it means when you look at the breath, you're training yourself to pick out the beauty in it. And you find it's easy to do. You train in all sorts of other things, and then you can train with the breath. And when you get to that calm breath, you just see the beauty. Wow, this is amazing. Beautiful breath. This is lovely. You're developing the piti sukha. The next stage in the meditation is actually to calm that piti sukha down, because sometimes it gets so strong, that bliss with the breath, that sometimes people start crying or even shaking. Wow! See? That's standard meditation teachings. You can see it in the Visuddhimagga. This is where you need to calm it down, because that piti sukha can get a bit too coarse. And because it's so bubbly and so sort of exciting, so if you don't calm it down, it'll just be a bit too disturbing. You know, as if you've developed it but it's got a bit too high, and you need to sort of calm it down to a middle way. And so it becomes the piti sukha like a happiness, which is really delicious but very soft. And as a meditator, you sort of understand just how to balance, you know, these piti sukhas. Like, just turn up the knob, not too much, not too little. It's like putting seasoning in your food. You know, not too much, not too little. It's just nice. And you get this seasoning of the breath with piti sukha, with joy. Which is just nice. Not too strong, not too much chili, not too much salt, not too much this or that. Just nice. And it's just nice because it's delightful enough to hold you, but not too delightful to disturb you. And that's a beautiful piti sukha. So this is the seventh stage, is calming down the piti sukha. Not destroying it, but just calming down, making it very still. Actually, that's the eighth stage. I missed the seventh stage. It's just feeling the piti sukha together. And the eighth stage is calming down that piti sukha. As you calm down that piti sukha, usually what happens next, quite naturally, you've got this very beautiful breath. And because you're calming the piti sukha down, calming, you find actually that all your attention is going on this joy and peace. And you notice that the breath has disappeared. And all you're left with is the piti sukha, the joy, the happiness. This is where before I told a simile of anyone who's read Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland. You know, he had some very beautiful metaphors in that book. This particular metaphor was where Alice and the Red Queen saw the Cheshire Cat, a head of a Cheshire Cat appear in the sky. And it was just the head, and the Red Queen said, and they didn't like it, so they said, off with its head. Because that's what it's always saying, for those of you who know the story. And the executioner said, I can't cut off its head, you know, there's no body, nothing to cut it off from. But anyway, this Cheshire Cat was smiling. It's a type of species of cat which has always got this natural smile on it. And according to the story, the Cheshire Cat started to disappear, started to fade away. And first its ears disappeared, and then its whiskers went, and then its eyes went, and then the rest of its face went, and it was just the lips. And then the lips disappeared, leaving only the smile. The smile with nothing to do with the smiling. A wonderful metaphor from Lewis Carroll, Mr. Dodgson, his real name was. And it's a wonderful simile, because that describes what happens in the next stage of the meditation. Which, you read, this is when it gets, again, very deep, very profound, very mystical, you might say, because here the breath disappears, and what's left is the beauty. The piti sukha is what remains. It's the simile which I gave earlier on in this retreat. It's like having a beautiful Buddha statue. And the Buddha statue completely disappears, leaving only the shine. Only the mental part of it, the physical part of it, is all gone. And because that smile, that shine, that piti sukha is a mental object. It lives in the realm of the mind. It doesn't live out there in the world. The breath was your vehicle. It's taken you to where you need to go. It's now disappeared. And all you've got left is part of the mind. That's why the next stage of the meditation, the ninth stage in the Anapanasati Sutta, was experiencing that mind. Experiencing that piti sukha, that joy, without any breath, just the bliss. Most people would experience that bliss as what we call the nimitta, this beautiful light which appears in the mind. It does not matter what the shape of that light is, what color it is. In these retreats we've had everything from blue, black, gold, white, pink. Whatever it is, as long as it is beautiful, not just any old gold, or not just any old blue, but the most beautiful blue you've ever seen in your whole life. And not just many colours, or not many shapes, moving backwards and forwards, because you want simplicity, not complexity. If you get to that stage, you're watching the beautiful breath, get this piti sukha coming up, you calm it down, and what you're left with is just, you know, a lot of images, flashing lights, a lot of detail. Then you've calmed down too quickly. You have stayed with the breath a bit longer, until the breath was very, very soft, and very smooth, and nothing much happening. You've got off into the mind when it's still been too agitated, and it makes a lot of these images. That's why sometimes one of the first common images which people come up with fireworks, things flashing here, going there. Great fun. Don't sort of kick yourself or tear yourself off if you get those sorts of images coming up in the mind, because they're really useful. It shows you're getting somewhere, and it's, you know, a little payoff for some of the hard work you've been doing. but you know, it's not really good enough yet. Enjoy it for a little while, then go back to the breath and do some more work. And go to the beautiful breath and stay there much longer. And then when the sort of the smile of the Cheshire Cat, the shine of the Buddha, the beauty starts to come up, it comes up as a beautiful object in the mind's eye. It is the amount of beauty which is important, as well as the stillness and simplicity of that object. And when that sort of first started coming up, you sometimes wonder, actually, what is this? Are you imagining this? Are you not imagining this? Don't have any doubts about this. At this stage, it's a real thing in the mind. Whether you think it's imaginary or not, doesn't really matter. As long as it's there, as it's staying. Trust it, have faith in it. And it will last a long time. That once that comes up, that yosa is very important, it's very useful to actually know what it actually is. And what it actually is, it is a mind object, it's actually the reflection of your mind at that particular state. Just as the same as if you're looking in a mirror at your own face in the morning, here it is, that which we call the mind, looking at the mind. And don't go into philosophy of what is the nature of the mind with thinking. This is experience. You're actually face to face with your mind, the jitta. It's been freed from all the other five senses, including the body. At this stage, you know there's an emperor there who's giving orders and ruling everything, but you actually don't know what's underneath. Those five clothes, the hat, the scarf, the tunic, the trousers, the boots, symbolize the five senses. They cover up this thing we call the mind. They cover it up so completely that all we see is the five senses and we don't really know what's underneath. You know, what's turning these senses on? What's directing them? What's receiving all the information? All we see is sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. That's all we know. It's just like the clothes covering the emperor. And in this meditation, you're taking all those clothes off until the last of the clothes is completely off, and then you can actually see the emperor, you know, bare for what he really is, or she really is, or rather it really is. You're seeing the mind. The five senses are gone. You're just left with that which we call the mind, the chitta. And that usually will appear as this beautiful, bright, pure light in the mind. You're not seeing a light. The sight is gone. It's a mental experience. You only interpret it as a light. This is where sanya perception, sort of when you understand what perception is, you understand why you're seeing what you are seeing. The only real thing there is the beauty and the stillness, the happiness, the joy. All the other things is perception just adds on, so you can understand what's going on. That's what sanya does. It takes reality, adds a few descriptions on it, so it's intelligible to you. So when you get to this stage, it's this beautiful nimitta which comes up. Sometimes people just have feelings of piti sukha, but it's not physical feeling, it's the mental feeling. That's okay, but it's not as skillful. If you can actually turn that into an image, a mental image, it's much more skillful, much more useful. You can actually do more things with it. Once that comes up, the Buddha said, once you can feel that, experience that, the next thing is actually to pamojan, which is give it a bit of joy, more joy. What is it? Delight it, embellish it. Just give it delight, because sometimes when the first nimitta comes up, it can be beautiful, but not beautiful enough. It's like you've got to shine it up a bit more, which is this, what is it, 8th, 9th, 10th stage of the meditation. Pramojyang chitang. Because for the mind, again, to be able to hold this thing, that nimitta has to be just very powerful to really hold your attention. Has to be extremely beautiful. And the skillful way of shining up that nimitta, making it more beautiful, is to look at its center. Because usually in the center, the most delicious part is. Just like a chocolate. The delicious part is right in the centre, you know, the nice soft, sweet filling, whatever it is. So the same with these nimittas, these beautiful things. If you see a beautiful blue nimitta or a black nimitta, just go to the very middle of it, and there you find the most beautiful part. And then go to the middle of that, and it's even more beautiful. You're actually shining up the mind, giving it more joy, more happiness. And at the same time, you've got to be careful that you're calming that thing down, which is the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th stage. I know the stages, but I don't know the numbers. The 11th stage is where you samadhan chittang. You calm the whole thing down, so it becomes very still. Because the two important parts in this stage, the beauty of that nimitta, make it very strong, very amazingly enjoyable, and also keep it still. The way to keep it still is to understand Ajahn Chah's simile of the still forest pool. And actually that simile is an incredibly evocative and accurate simile of what happens with the mind. Ajahn Chah, forest monk, would go wandering in the jungles alone. When it came to late afternoon, he'd try and find a lake, a river, somewhere where he could bathe, wash some clothes, and drink some water. You always used to carry a water filter with you. And very often he'd find a nice lake or river in the middle of the jungles, he'd wash, bathe, and have some water for drinking, and then when he was all ready, he'd sit meditation, a little way away from the edge of the pool. And sometimes he would just sit there, not meditating, with his eyes open. And if he was very still, the animals would come out of the jungle in the evening, also to drink, and to play, and to wash themselves. But if he moved, the animals would know he was there, and would not come out. So the only way that he could watch those animals was by being very still. And in this simile he said sometimes he was so still, but not only the ordinary jungle animals would come out, they didn't know he was there, because he was absolutely still. But once they finished drinking and washing, he said he saw these amazing animals come out, which he never realized existed before. His parents, his teachers, the other monks had never told him that there were such animals. Wonderful animals, amazing beings, would also come and drink. But those animals were very, very shy. And if he even blinked an eyelid, then they would know there was a human being there, and they wouldn't come out at all. But if they did come out, and they blinked, they'd go out again, they wouldn't come out for many days, many weeks. They knew they were being watched. He had to be absolutely still, then they'd come out. It's a marvelous simile for the nimittas, for that 11th stage of the Anapanasati. Calming things down. That which is watching has to be still. And if at that stage of the meditation, that which watches the mindfulness doesn't even blink, just so still, and all these beautiful nimittas will come out. But if you say, wow, that's it, they're gone. They run back into the jungle, they don't come out for days and days and days and days. You've blown it. Or if you get afraid, because some of these jungle animals can be very big. Tigers, white tigers. And if you are afraid, that's it, they've seen you. They won't come out again. Those are the two major obstacles to that stage. And that's in the Upakalesa Sutta, which the Buddha taught. Every stage he taught some amazing teachings of meditation. Fear and excitement. Be wary of those two. You get so close to these amazing things happening in the mind. The excitement. Wow! I've got to tell Ajahn Brahm about this. Oh, just Ajahn Brahm, I'm going to write a question so everybody knows how well I'm doing for the evening. So, excitement and fear. Watch out for those two. There's nothing to be afraid of, and excitement is just pulling you back right to the beginning again. So once you understand those two as dangers, then you'll be able to avoid them, and you'll be able to take those the 10th and 11th stages of Anapanasati, to be able to brighten up that nimitta, shine it up so it's so beautiful. Just giving it energy, that's all. Giving the knower energy, I should have said. Giving the knower energy, mindfulness more energy, and samadhan, keeping the knower still. And then this nimitta will be so bright and so still. You get the feeling of being sucked in. It's called vimochayang chittang, freeing the mind. And that's where the mind gets completely freed of the body, of sounds, of thoughts. You've entered a jhana. That's the 12th stage of Anapanasati, entering those jhanas. It's called freeing the mind. And when you've experienced those things many, many times, you understand why it's called freeing the mind. This mind, this jitta, is just so captivated by the world, by the body, by things, by thoughts. It really is a prisoner in a torture chamber. And once you can actually free that, get it out of prison for the first time, so the mind is free of this body and seeing and feeling the pains and the aches in this body and seeing things and having to eat and having to scratch and do this and do that. When it's free of all of that, it's absolute bliss. And if you get into those sorts of states, you'll be completely blissed out and you'll be going around the rest of this retreat with a stupid smile on your face. And no matter what people say about you, you just be smiling. Because these are powerful energy states which you'll never be able to forget. And they make the whole thing about meditation worthwhile. When you come out of those jhana states, I'll talk more about them later on, because this is what I want to do to inspire you and to hold the lollies in front of you so you're going to so you know they're there, so I'm going to get these. Once you come out of these things, then you get the reflections, which is the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th part of Anapanasati Sutta. This is breath meditation. It's not just calming the mind down, it's getting the insights from them. Then you start to contemplate the first thing, anicca. What anicca means is not just rise and fall, not just change. I give the simile again of a TV set, because I like to give similes from, you know, your real life. TV set, you can see the programs change. You can see the images flash up and disappear again. You can even see what happens when you turn the programs off and just a blank screen there. But in your life, have you ever seen your television actually disappearing in front of your eyes? With all the wood electronics, now they're there and now they're absolutely gone. This is what anicca means for meditation. It's not just things rising and falling, it's things disappearing. And that's spooky. And if you're there in your house and you see your television, and you're just watching it there, and suddenly it's gone. Where's it gone? Has it been transported by some UFO or something? Here you actually see things which have been there all the time. The screen of consciousness, gone. Will, doing, gone. Your whole body just vanished. It's not there. When you start seeing these things in these deep meditations, then you really understand just how powerful this anicca really is. They're really gone, not just coming and going, not just vibrating, just disappeared. Where the heck's that gone to? And that's why it becomes powerful insights, because they really shock you. And that's the first contemplation, anicca, just to see just how things which once were there are no longer there anymore. And the next one I think is patinissaka, which is like, see this throwing away. What have you thrown away to get into these stages? And to know that was the path, throwing away, letting go. You contemplate letting go, what that word truly is, because you've done some real letting go for a change. And you contemplate, I think, viraga, just things fading away, dispassion. If you contemplate nirodha, that these things can actually cease. All these four things, they all link together. You're contemplating cessation, the ending of things. especially what's nice to do after one of these deep meditations, just contemplate the Four Noble Truths, which is those four things just in a nutshell. Why was that the most blissful experience you've ever had in your life? Not, you know, just beat it by a whisker, but beat it by sort of miles and miles and miles, different league of happiness. Why? What caused it? Now, in each of those jhana states, the Buddha called it actually Sambodhisukha, the bliss of enlightenment. It's not enlightenment, but it's close enough, according to the Buddha's words, to give it that title. Close enough to enlightenment. Call it enlightenment happiness, Sambodhisukha. So contemplate that, and you've got all the data necessary to penetrate and see what the Buddha saw, at least become a stream winner. You've seen the ending of things. You've seen the nature of mind, what this body is and the five senses and what the mind is, what the knower is, what the doer is. You see the whole lot as being the things which come and go, can fade away and disappear, can end. And to see that their ending is bliss. The more you give away, the more happiness you have. You see that for yourself. Those are the insights which come up based on that amount of data. So that is the Anapanasati Sutta taught by the Lord Buddha. Incredibly profound. Very accurate to what happens if you meditate properly. Giving all the advice, all the instructions, laying out so carefully, so beautiful, and taking it not just halfway, but right to the very end. Beautiful teachings. So I taught this morning, hopefully to inspire you, to show you the path, to get those deep meditations, to encourage you that it's possible, to give you the tips, and to make sure that that path, you know exactly what you're supposed to be doing, you're encouraged to do it, and so it gives you maximum opportunity to achieve something during this meditation retreat. Any questions? Yeah?
If your question is a comment, the comment about the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
I don't think this morning my gatekeeper is a Swiss lorry.
What is
it? It's not a Swiss lorry, Tadajan.
Swiss lorry?
Yeah, it's like it's not a Swiss watch.
Not a Swiss watch. You mean you got up this morning but your gatekeeper didn't?
No.
So, yeah.
I told...
Oh, you're sleeping.
No, no, that I said that I want to get up at 4:30. First thing I can say, I should get up at 4. I can get up at 4:30.
Yeah.
So I get up at 10 to 4.
10 to 4, okay. That's because the gatekeeper was listening to me, not to you. That's a good gatekeeper. Very good. Any other questions anyone's got? Okay, so really get in there and get some nice meditation going. Don't think that because you've just begun to meditate that you are not as likely as anybody else to get these deep meditations. Don't think that because you've had bad meditations all through the first 3 days, you can't really get the good one now. In that little booklet, I gave the simile of the workman going to work Monday, working really hard, and at the end of Monday, got nothing to show for it. Doesn't get paid, goes home tired, as broke as ever. Tuesday, the same thing happens. Works really hard, Wednesday hard, still gets nothing. Goes to work on Thursday and is getting pretty sort of tired of all this, wondering whether to give up and change jobs because he's working but not getting paid. And still doesn't get paid. And Friday he goes to work and works maybe not even as hard as he did on Thursday. And at the end of the day he gets a paycheck. Wow, at last. I did it right today. I must have done something wrong on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Why can't every day be payday? Now, of course, you know from that simile that you've got to work. many days before you get paid. Many meditations you do, you don't get paid. It doesn't mean they're bad meditations. All it means is you're doing the work, you're building up steam. Even those things you think are bad meditations, and you're struggling here, struggling there, they are part of the whole course which gives you the good meditations, which give you the paycheck. There is no such thing as a bad meditation. No such thing at all. There's only a thing as no meditation, but not something as bad meditation. So that gives you confidence. If you keep on putting forth more and more bad meditations, payday is coming closer and closer and closer. So don't be discouraged. That paycheck is in the mail. Okay, so please, may you get paid today.